Hi, I'm Allison Kulo.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
The last time many Americans thought about how ports handle containerized cargo was when we watched the second season of The Wire. And while Baltimore is playing only a bit role in this year's drama, what is happening at ports from Ningbo to Long Beach to Savannah is having a major impact on what consumer goods are on store shelves and on the inflation we see across the economy.
The world's shipping crisis is so acute that the White House held a press event last week to announce that the Port of Los Angeles would now operate 24 hours a day. But it is far from clear that this, or frankly anything that governments could do, is likely to ameliorate conditions in the short run. And shipping backlogs are likely to result in major disruptions in the availability of consumer goods as we head into the holiday season. The Grinch this year may well be a cargo ship with tens of thousands of containers floating for days off the coast of California, unable to dock.
While most of us didn't see this one coming, Business Insider reporter Rachel Premack certainly did. Back in June, Premack published detailed reporting on how the world was heading into a major shipping crisis. So how do we get here? What is causing the supply chain to be so badly disrupted? How is it affecting what we can get and what it's going to cost? And more importantly, how and when is the situation likely to resolve? We're very lucky to have Rachel Premack with us this morning. Good morning, Rachel, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Rachel, can we start with a little bit of how we got here? And I guess my first question would relate, how did the pandemic sort of affect the global supply chain as background?
In early 2020, once we were all basically trapped inside for a few months, all the money and all the time that we would have spent, you know, going out to eat, traveling, going to movies, instead we spent all of that time indoors buying stuff online. So we saw in 2020 container, imports to the U.S. rise quite a bit. The really unprecedented amount of imports coming to the U.S. because we were buying things, we were looking to spend money not on experiences but on durable goods. So going from 2020 into 2021, we've just had an unusual amount of stuff basically coming into our ports, and that's caused an unprecedented basically burden on the ports to import all of this and to deliver it to our store shelves or to our doorsteps.
What is the importance of the larger ships that now are a part of this international shipping? I know for myself, I didn't realize how important shipping was till that one ship got stuck in the Suez Canal. And it started opening my eyes about how this works.
Right. So the typical cargo ship delivered today has actually increased fivefold in size since 1990. So that's why, you know, in earlier this year, we saw the Ever Given stuck in the Suez Canal, because the Suez Canal and other sorts of shipping infrastructure, so ports, other canals, these are all built for much smaller ships. And just in the past few decades, they've really increased in size. And that's so basically shipping companies can make more money, so they can import more things with each shipment. And so it's just scales of economies of scale, just trying to get as much into a single shipment as possible.
Can you help our audience sort of understand what it would mean when we talk about, in one of your articles you talked about a containerized cargo vessel holding 11,000 containers. I'm trying to sort of visualize what that would mean in terms of how much stuff it would go in 11,000 containers. Is there any way to help visualize that?
Yeah, so one container is typically about 40 feet long, so that can hold millions and millions of dollars of goods. So that could be, you know, tens of thousands of toys, many semiconductors, or lots and lots of. It is hard to really visualize how much can fit in one of these, but if you can picture a 40-foot container and picture just stuffing it with goods that might be, soft, so you can really fit more and more in, or maybe a little more damageable, like a piece of furniture that, you know, you can't really scratch it or pile a bunch on top of each other. It is hard to really picture, but that is how most of our practically everything we touch and interact with day to day ends up in one of these containers, or started its journey to us in one of these containers.
Can you share some insight a little bit, because you had talked about how the shipping containers have grown in size so much since 1990, and that these shipping containers are larger so that they can ship more. Did we lose like a middle section of suppliers? Were there smaller ships and now we're just seeing bigger, or are we just needing to transport that much more goods?
Right, so the containers have stayed the same size. They're still around 40 feet typically. It's just that the ships themselves have gotten that much bigger. And the shipping industry is really built, comprised of a few large shipping companies. So you think about Maersk or CGM, which is a French company. It's a few large companies that dominate the sector. And there used to be other shipping companies, but these have really consolidated over the past few years into just dominating the industry with these few particularly large shipping companies.
So you have an image of massive traffic jams at these various ports, the various major ports. Let's sort of break down some of the issues that we're seeing. One of the things that I saw in one of your articles is that we have ships that are having to stay offshore for longer periods of time because they can't get into the port to unload them. How much is that happening, and what does that do to the system?
Right, so right now we've really seen a peak in how many ships are waiting off the coast of Los Angeles and Long Beach. So as of last week, it was about 60 to 65 ships waiting to port, or waiting to dock, rather. And pre-pandemic, you basically would never see a ship waiting outside. Maybe you'd see one or two, but very rarely would any number of ships be waiting to dock. And now we're seeing, you know, up to 65 last week. And what that shows is just how backlogged everything is. So, you know, starting from 2020, we started ordering more stuff that caused more of a backlog for ports, specifically in East Asia and China, to, you know, get these goods out the door. And then that causes delays when there's not enough, there aren't enough ports in Los Angeles, Long Beach for those ships. It's kind of this compounding factor where one thing is delayed, the next thing is delayed, and then, you know, fast forward 18 months and we have 65 ships waiting to dock. It's really a domino effect.
Knowing that the port of Los Angeles is now going to stay open 24 hours a day, how many ships does that allow them to now increase kind of that turnaround to? I'm assuming, you know, looking at how large these ships are, how long does it take for them to be unloaded, and how long is it going to take to even just get through the current backlog?
Right, so it's not quite clear yet how long this particular backlog will take to go through, because we are, you know, more ships are still coming every day, more shipments are still en route to our ports. But some experts in the shipping industry say that this 24-hour new mandate probably won't actually help much. Part of the reason for that is that right now there is the companies that service the ports with truck drivers are struggling to find truck drivers to do these jobs. So if there's a shortage of drivers at the ports, that means that, you know, whether it's open 24 hours a day or 12 hours a day or however many hours a day, we're not going to really be able to get these shipments moving, to get these containers moving. So the 24 hours a day, experts say that's a good start. It's a good first step. And it's good, first of all, that the federal government is looking into the shipping industry. But it's not something that many experts say is really going to fix the problem or make a meaningful impact on the problem.
You know, the picture that emerges to me is one of bottleneck after bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
Getting enough longshoremen to unload the ships is an issue. Getting enough truck drivers to drive them away is an issue. I read a piece over the weekend where in Savannah, they have unloaded a bunch of containers that are just sitting there because they can't get anybody to move them. How bad are each of those bottlenecks, and how do we resolve some of them?
Yeah, so a lot of these have just been kind of lurking in the background for years and years. So in the trucking industry, there's a, basically the industry goes back and forth from having too many truck drivers, and then you see waves of bankruptcies, mass layoffs, and then pulling back and having not enough truck drivers. And then that's when you see companies doling out these massive raises, these huge bonuses, trying to get more drivers into the industry. So just looking at truck driving specifically, there's just a lot of back and forth, a lot of instability in that market. And we kind of do see that in shipping more generally, where, you know, sometimes the economy is super hot, like right now, and we need more ships, more containers, more workers, more of everything. But then if you look at, say, 2019 or maybe the very early few months of the coronavirus crisis, that's when imports were falling. Experts were pretty bearish on the economy, predicting recessions. Spending was down, you know, jobs were not growing. So it's both in shipping and in trucking, and kind of just throughout supply chain, you see a lot of really big back and forth swings. And I think probably the best way to stabilize the market would just for there to be some sort of way to ensure that, you know, companies can ensure kind of steady profits, that there isn't this sort of insane ups and insane downs. And I think we're kind of seeing the effects of what happens when there isn't more stability in supply chain right now.
You know, eventually we've talked a lot about how we're having delays, and eventually I want to get to the impact on price and how it's affecting sort of importers. But I had another question as we think about these bottlenecks. Another issue is, if we got all this stuff coming in, are there enough containers from where it's coming from? In other words, are we going to have like a bunch of empty containers here that really should be someplace else?
Right. Yeah, that's been one of the big questions and one of the big concerns these past few months. So a few months ago, maybe, you know, earlier this summer, a big conversation point was that in the U.S., we were kind of stockpiling all of these empty containers, because even though imports are up in the U.S., we're actually exporting less right now. So we have all these empty containers. It would make sense to ship all these empty containers back to East Asia, and specifically China, so they can be reloaded and more goods can come over. But that was definitely a point of contention, because there are, you know, farmers and agricultural producers in the U.S. who want to fill those containers with their own goods and, you know, make money for their own businesses. But there was definitely a bit of a fighting point between shipping companies that were saying, okay, we need to get these empty containers out right away as soon as they're unloaded. And then farmers in the U.S. who are saying, no, we need a few more days to fill up these containers with our own goods and our own products. So that's just one example of the seemingly like endless things that are going on right now, is that there was a bit of a shortage of containers in the places where they needed to be. Another reason for why there was a container shortage a few months back was that in 2019, as well as early 2020, when, you know, people were uncertain about what direction the coronavirus crisis would lead us in, whether that meant huge recessions or, people buying more and more, end up being the latter, of course. These shipping companies, these shipping container manufacturers just stopped making as many containers, because they figured, okay, there's a recession right now, or this pandemic could cause a recession, we should not make so many containers. So on top of there being unprecedented trade volumes, we also have fewer containers than we need right now, and fewer containers were being produced right now, a few months back. So the domino effect, compounding crisis, bottleneck after bottleneck, everything's kind of coming to a head right now. And it's definitely an unprecedented time.
As you're finding out, as this topic becomes more and more a focus of mm-hmm. people, we're learning about how all this works. Wondering if you could go back for a second pre-pandemic, and tell me, how did those shipping containers make their way out of the U.S.? Like, when a big ship is unloaded, do we load it back up immediately and it goes off? And then I guess my next question is, too, is are other ports in the world getting backed up just like we are?
Right. So this is definitely an issue that we are seeing in Europe, in Asia. Specifically, a few months ago, at one of the largest ports around Shanghai, there was a coronavirus outbreak and there were fewer workers there. So that was causing a huge backlog at those ports. And we're kind of seeing, you know, some more industrial action and other sorts of ports. I think this morning in Italy, a group of Italian supply chain workers are announcing a strike because they disagree with the new vaccine mandate. There's been kind of pushback around vaccine mandates among supply chain workers in the U.S. So that is definitely, we are definitely seeing this issue elsewhere. In typical times, you know, a shipping container, you know, a ship with all of the stuff that you bought from IKEA or Wayfair or what have you, would go on a ship in a container, loaded on a ship, perhaps in Shanghai, in one of the ports there, travel across the ocean. That takes about a 2 to 3 week journey, and then it would often dock, let's say, in the port of Long Beach. It would be offloaded by longshoremen, placed onto trucks. The trucks would perhaps, you know, continue on with the journey on a truck or be placed on a train and then unloaded at a fulfillment center or a warehouse and then eventually make its way to a store or your doorstep. And basically every part of that process nowadays is getting hit or, blocked in some ways.
You know, we've talked about sort of the backup. Let's talk about some of the impacts, and there are really two that I can think of that I want to cover. The first one is money. Anytime you have something that's hyper demand, you see price increases. What's going on in terms of what it costs to ship a container, and how is that likely to impact us as consumers?
Right. So we are seeing the price of a container, the price to ship a good, just incredibly skyrocket in the past year or so. There have been plenty of Amazon sellers specifically who can kind of anecdotally say, okay, it would cost me maybe $1,000 to $2,000 to move a container from China to the US. Nowadays that might cost up to $20,000 for just one container. And we haven't seen so far a ton of, I would say, like, unusually kind of or unprecedented kind of price increases quite yet. We have seen, maybe smaller, we have seen consumer packaged goods increase in prices. So companies like PepsiCo have announced that Lay's chips or Mountain Dew are going to be increasing in prices. And that's just because, those sorts of products are such a low margin business. So if any part of the process in shipping or supply chain goes up even a little bit in price, that often is reflected down to the price that you see at the store. I'm definitely going to be interested to see how, Amazon sellers or other sorts of small businesses decide to change the prices for various goods, especially this Christmas, because things are, if these importers haven't already got their products in for Christmas 2021, it will definitely be a challenge to get what you need to get in. And, the more things are delayed, the more things that are scarce, we're just going to see price increases more and more.
And let me ask my Grinch question. You just indicated that if the various sellers haven't gotten stuff on ships already, they're probably in trouble. Where would you see us having the most likely kinds of shortages as we go into the holiday season? In other words, what's going to be hard to get, in your view?
Well, what's going to be hard to get is definitely just anything that's larger or more fragile, I would say. It's going to be easier to pack, clothing or, squishy toys. We even saw a CNN report a few days ago just on, how it's just going to be easier to, press, small plush toys into a container rather than, you know, trying to get, I'm just kind of looking around my room right now, you know, a table, not that anyone would ever give a table for Christmas, but I mean, even pre-Christmas, I'm sure basically anyone who I've talked to who's tried to order furniture online, it's a months and months and months and months delay. So anything you want that's like big or bulky, maybe shift instead to a gift card or, you know, some clothes or something soft and squishy for sure.
I have this vision of a container full of plush toys that have been compacted and have squeakers in them making noise. Yeah. And go all the way across the ocean. Anyway.
Maybe don't buy those because those will not be in the best condition.
Let's talk, before we wrap up, can we talk a little bit about how this is going to fix itself or how or get fixed?
Yeah. And the one other thing I'd have to add to things to expect a delay on is definitely anything that has a semiconductor. So, you know, that's a phone, a car. I don't know if you'd ever give a car for Christmas, but, you know.
We should be so lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Anything with a semiconductor, it's probably, there might be a delay on that as well. How this gets fixed is, it's nothing that any individual can really control, but as a general rule, if we just stop buying as much stuff and instead start, you know, going to restaurants, going out to movies, going to travel, that will actually help this crisis quite a bit, because what's happening is that our ports are so overloaded with trying to manage all the stuff that we're all buying, that they just need like a reset period and a moment to kind of catch up, and you know, catch up and kind of get back into action. But interestingly, you know, a lot of experts expected that this would have happened months ago, that, you know, more people are vaccinated, more things have been reopened. Of course, people are going to be buying less stuff. But in fact, we have not actually seen that at all. In fact, the volumes increased over the spring, and they've kind of gently gone down, but it hasn't been the drop that I think many experts were hoping for.
We've been talking to Rachel Premack, who, by the way, has a wonderfully interesting variety of topics that she writes on. But among them is her wonderful reporting on the shipping crisis. Rachel, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Last week, Mountain West Capital Network announced Dynamic Blending as the top-ranked company in the 2021 Utah 100. Now, in its 27th year, the Utah 100 is MWCN's annual list of the fastest-growing companies in the state. MWCN ranks the Utah 100 by revenue growth from both percentage of increase and a dollar increase over a five-year period through 2020. Joining us this morning to talk about the results of those rankings is Ryan Dent, president-elect of MWCN, and Dave Chase, Utah 100 chairman. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So this is a big thing for Mountain West Capital Network every year, to be able to rank these, you know, the top 100 companies. Why don't you explain why you find it's essential to rank these companies in Utah?
Well, this is Dave Chase. It's for us as Mountain West Capital Network, this ranking is an opportunity for us to really showcase all of the amazing work in the entrepreneurship in Utah. It's really a celebration of the entrepreneurship that's happening in and around Utah that we see continuing to emerge each year. And it really just becomes a celebration of everybody in the room and what they've done to contribute to that entrepreneurship in the state.
I want to ask about how the ranking process works, but first, can you tell us a little bit about what Mountain West Capital does generally? I just want to understand who you guys are a little bit.
Right. Yeah. You know, Mountain West Capital Network is one of the oldest and most successful kind of business networking organizations, nonprofit organizations in the state of Utah. You know, founded over 30 years ago, it was really an opportunity for business professionals who were involved in, you know, successful companies, capital movement in the state of Utah, to really get together and find ways to showcase the success that our state was having, whether it's through recognition of the Utah 100 or you know, finding that Entrepreneur of the Year that we recognize every year, or, you know, the deal flow book that we publish, which shows all the capital deals that occurred and mergers and acquisitions that occurred with tied to Utah companies, you know, over the year. Those are things that, we focus on, really trying to highlight, as Dave kind of mentioned with this event, the great things that are happening in our state with these companies.
Dave, how does the ranking process work?
Yeah, if you watch the event or you're aware of the event, you'll recognize that it's more than just the Utah 100, even though that's the name of this, our signature event. It really begins with selecting the top 15 revenue companies. And once a company has made that list, they're precluded from making the Utah 100 list, for example. So priority goes to that top 15 revenue. And then those Utah 100 companies are ranked on a blend of dollar growth and percentage growth through a five-year period, 2016 to 2020, and that just rolls forward each year. And then there are a handful of companies that are really exciting to watch, have not yet had 5 years of existence, and we identify, usually in the mid-teens, 15 this year, companies that we call emerging elite.
What we spend a lot of time talking about Utah businesses. We speak with the Utah World Trade Center. Utah is known for its startup and tech community. And I was surprised that this year's fastest growing company, and quite frankly, a few of the top 10, were more manufacturing based. And this year's fastest growing company manufactures cosmetics. Can you tell us about Dynamic Blending? What do they do and how are they doing it right?
Yeah, isn't that fascinating? And we oftentimes are equated with being a tech center, and rightly so. There's a lot of those top 10 companies that are, and certainly the top 100, but we do have a mix of other great companies. Dynamic Blending is one example. You know, they're a Utah County-based company that has been in operation for a few years, focused on personal goods, cosmetics, where they're not a branding company per se, but they're partnering with lots and lots of large brands, small brands, emerging brands, to help develop, manufacture, R&D, and even help on the business side, which is where they've been really successful. It's taking those small emerging brands, taking what they've observed from the larger companies on how they've been successful, and offering services to these smaller companies that are emerging to become a little bit more like their larger peers, and helping them with their branding, their placement, not only their manufacturing and their R&D. It's a pretty amazing, dynamic, fast-growing organization.
So that's really interesting. So they are sort of making goods of cosmetics, I guess, that other people market under their brand names. They're almost like a back-end shop. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Huh. Very interesting. I don't know if that's common in the cosmetics industry or not. Let me ask about Thread Wallets. That showed up as the second fastest growing company. And by the way, I assume it gets harder to be the fastest growing company year over year because you've got a larger denominator for the year going forward.
That's right. That's right. Now, Thread Wallets is another one that, you know, they've been on the list now more than once. This is like their third time being listed, if I recall correctly. And they're a good example of a consumer products business. We've got quite a few consumer products businesses in the state, and they are emerging as another category that we're becoming well known for. Thread Wallets is one who they've gotten really smart. They started with a little wallet that's pretty minimalist, which speaks to their strategy of being slim, focused on design, and they've begun to expand. So the reason they've been growing is they've stayed true to their purpose, that is, let's be a carry company, is how they self-describe themselves now. And now they offer all kinds of things, ways to carry your essentials with you in a stylish sort of way, just really minimalist.
I was surprised. I was just down at Fashion Place Mall this weekend and saw that they have like a little kiosk out in the middle of the mall. They're not a full-time tenant, I would say, for that, which made me just so surprised. They must have other outlets that they're selling. It must not just be, you know, like an in-person. Is digital a big piece for them?
Yeah, I can maybe comment on that. So, you know, we've seen them, obviously, they started by, you know, selling these products at farmers markets, at outdoor venues, you know, and they obviously have a number of kiosks on their own throughout some of the retail market space. But they also, we've seen them in stores, we've seen them, you know, being on shelves of some of the bigger stores throughout the state as well and throughout the country. So I think they're expanding, they're growing, obviously, as you can tell, but their distribution channels have also expanded quite a bit since they started.
Who's the superstar among the tech community? Because obviously we hear a lot about the Silicon Slopes, and it really is an important part of the future of the Utah economy. Which is the fastest growing company that you saw within that sphere?
I would think of the top 10. There were a couple in the part of this depending on how do you define
exactly.
Tech. So many people say that's just software. And there's a lot of people, because it is a hot space, that want to call themselves tech companies. And you might find that a number of them do claim that. But if you go down that top 10 list, you'd find some. Certainly Awardco, which was the top winner last year, is very much a tech software company. There's a lot of products companies tucked around them. But there are companies that are a mix of product and technology, marketplaces even in Utah that are strong, service-based organizations that employ technology, like Motivosity in the top 10, that is very much a tech company.
So let's go back and explain to the audience what Awardco does.
Yeah, I can maybe touch on that. When we recognized them last year as the fastest growing company, it was fascinating to understand their story. They really are trying to connect employers with their employees in a meaningful way, and find ways that the employers can provide recognition. And so they actually have given employers probably the best selection of products you could find to recognize and provide meaningful, you know, gratitude to their employees. And then they, you know, really focused on the distribution, the selection, the distribution, and the ability to get those products to the employees in a meaningful way. And the employers, through their partnership with Amazon, obviously have opened quite a marketplace for the types of products and the types of rewards and recognition that employers can now do. And so the volume that they produce really through Amazon and through some of their other partnerships, through some large employers, have really put them on the map.
Do they produce, you know, volume? So like when you're ordering, you know, thank you gifts for your employees, that's maybe where their bread and butter is? Or are they producing like specific individual pieces that these companies want for their employees?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm not sure I know the answer, but my understanding is it's probably a mix of both, right? They may have some of their own designs and some of their own products, but they really are tapping into some of the, you know, ways to brand existing products with company logos and different things that are meaningful to those companies and those employees.
You also mentioned Motivosity as another sort of tech-related company. Can you tell us a little bit about where they rank this year and what they do?
Motivosity was the seventh-ranked company this year. And Motivosity, like we have a handful of these in the state. I mean, Utah's a unique state where and I heard quite a bit of this week in the Silicon Slope Summit. There's quite a bit of discussion around the culture in Utah and people and having heart and compassion in business. And Motivosity is kind of squarely in the middle of that. They are a recognition-based software that helps recognize high performance inside of an organization and helps individuals make that part of their process, is recognizing peers and superiors and so on. There are many companies in the state that are starting to do some things like this. And this is a serial entrepreneur who built a strong culture in a previous business and felt like that was something he could build a software company around and help others do the same.
You mentioned that there's something about Utah's culture that led into that. What other types of businesses did you see on that list that you felt were maybe more Utah-centric or could have only come out of Utah?
That may speak to a general question that I, in my full-time role, where I spend quite a bit of time with smaller emerging companies, have begun to see this trend among entrepreneurs of confidence that doesn't exist in other places I've been. Meaning we have just seen this flywheel starting to spin in Utah of throwing off all kinds of successful entrepreneurs that yield a plethora of other entrepreneurs around them that believe, hey, I can do this too. And it's amazing to me to see in a variety of industries, from software to products to service related to manufacturing, of people stepping into entrepreneurship in ways that haven't existed in Utah in prior times. It's being taught in the colleges in really amazing ways. And we've got this culture that is becoming very much about entrepreneurship generally than specifically in verticals.
Obviously, last year was an unusual year. And I guess my question is, as you start to look at what's happening this year, as things are a little more open and more people are going back into physical spaces, are you seeing different companies emerging as showing higher growth because of the post-pandemic sort of environment?
I think there's no surprise to many who are watching that many e-commerce companies saw explosive growth this year. We, in the middle of 2020, everybody, you know, pumped the brakes a little bit, trying to figure out what's going on, and then realized there was still life going on. And e-commerce, because of all the brick and mortar that was shut down, really began to explode. And we were well positioned as a state generally for that because we have so many e-commerce focused businesses. So we saw that in personal goods, as you saw in Dynamic Blending. We saw that in pet goods. There's a pet goods company in there. There's all kinds of consumer-specific goods companies that really emerged in 2020. And we saw a heavier listing of those this year.
So seeing a heavy listing, starting to talk about trends, what other trends did you see as far as the companies that were on the list this year?
Yeah, Ryan and I were talking earlier this morning. One of the really fascinating trends is the diversity around geography. Historically, Salt Lake County has been the focus, the engine of growth in Utah. And of course, there have been companies elsewhere outside of that that were standouts. But what we saw this year is that continuing to accelerate to where, you know, 9 out of the top 10 companies listed are in what some might call the other downtown or the south downtown, kind of that point of the mountain area, North Utah County, South Salt Lake County. That's continuing to emerge as a real powerhouse in the state. But we saw companies from St. George all the way to Logan. So the geography trends are really interesting as the state is developing a total entrepreneur engine statewide, which is fascinating and really indicative of, I think, sustained economic growth in the state.
Yeah, a parallel question I would have to that is, are we seeing sort of, you know, startup tech communities emerging immediately outside the large technical campuses of the state? And, you know, in many states you see that exploding. Are we seeing that here in Utah?
Yeah, they're around, I mean, you think of where the big companies are located, there's stuff all around them. But the interesting thing is what you'll find if you really are watching is they are everywhere. Mm-hmm. You can't go more than a mile or two before you'll see yet another small grouping of companies you may not have heard much about, technical startups, consumer product startups. There are pockets everywhere in the state, which is really fascinating and exciting.
What could we look at, or what are you expecting to see for next year? You know, when we bring you back next October, what do you forecast that you'll see on this list?
That's a really great question. 2021, I think, has been anecdotally, and we don't have any data on 2021 yet, but anecdotally, we've seen a very similar trend to what we saw in the last half of 2020, which is what drove the list, honestly, because everybody was pausing that first part of the year. I think we'll see more of the same around consumer products, around services businesses, and around tech companies. If you watch the news, which of course you guys are squarely in the middle of, you'll have seen so many companies successfully raising rounds of capital to help accelerate their growth. Many of those will be on the list next year. Many of those have been on emerging elites and are accelerating quickly, and they're moving up the ranks really fast. So some of them will not be surprises. But like every year, there's somebody that comes out of the woodwork. Nobody knew much about them. Dynamic Blending is a case in point. They fly below the radar. I think we'll see more of those, because there's a lot of capital chasing these businesses that are accelerating quickly, and we don't know them all.
We appreciate your time. We've been speaking with Ryan Dent and Dave Chase. We've been talking about the Mountain West Capital Network, Utah's 100, which was just released last week. Gentlemen, thank you for joining Mountain Money. Opening this past June, Banchan American Izakaya is Park City's first Asian American izakaya. Located at 900 Main Street, which is in the lower Marriott Summit Watch complex, they offer a delicious and unique blend of Japanese, Korean, and American flavors. Joining us to talk about the new venture is Matt Fisher. Matt, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us on.
We are happy to start chatting with you. You have been working in Park City restaurants for quite some time, and I did take a peek at your background. You've been here since 1999. I know you had a brief stint in Jackson Hole, but you know, you're a staple in the Park City scene. I've known you with regards to sushi, but talk to me about what you opened here and why you thought it was good to bring to Park City.
Well, so as you stated, I worked in sushi bars around town, including originally Kanpai, which is where Yuki Yama is now, including Blind Dog, including Shabu Restaurant. And during this period, I also cultivated my cooking skills by running a catering business. And so basically the time came when I wanted to incorporate what I was doing outside of the sushi bar into my professional career. And so that meant sort of departing from the sushi world and doing a more broad, all-encompassing menu. And that was really the drive behind the impetus to create the restaurant. Sort of the crucial relationship was finding my partner, Jackson Knoll. Jackson Knoll is the proprietor of Jackson's Base Camp up at Park City Resort. And he is actually, as part of our effort to sort of cultivate this area in Lower Main, he's opening a new location, another Jackson's Base Camp that's just across the breezeway from the restaurant. So finding him as a partner played not only towards my desire to open the restaurant, but also towards the target audience that I wanted to sort of focus on. I've been an avid skier for years. That's why I settled here. Honestly, that's why I'm still here. There are many other attractive restaurant markets, but Park City is unique, obviously, in its mountain town character. And so from finding a partner within the ski industry, we sort of use that as a launching pad to cultivate this business that would attract the ski crowd. We felt like for years there's been somewhat of a void in Old Town as far as the strict après ski venue. Old Town is amazing as far as its charm, its convenience, and we love the lift here. But for years and years, there was no place for locals or the ski crowd to sort of matriculate when they got down to the bottom of town lift.
I like that
word.
There
are many fine restaurants here, but there's not necessarily the one that really focuses on the culture of skiing. And that's kind of where we want it to be.
Can you break down a little bit the name, Banchan and
sure.
American Izakaya Kaya? Tell us what those terms mean and how that is reflected in your menu.
So this kind of, the name was chosen to reflect the different elements that we wanted to bring in to the menu and also the character of the restaurant. Banchan is a Korean word that specifically means small plates. It refers to a lot of the side dishes that you would get at a Korean dinner that would be sort of compulsory on the table when you arrived, including kimchi, pickled vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. As far as our menu, we use that term small plates to kind of connote the sort of dining philosophy that we have. Allowing you to try many different things in moderate or smaller portions. And then the second part of the name, American Izakaya. Izakaya is a term that refers to a Japanese bar, perhaps bar and grill. It's an after work or late night venue that would serve accompanying food. But it's basically a place where you'd have a good time after the weekends or after your work ends.
Nice.
Obviously, we incorporated the American side because that plays to what my background here in the U.S. is. I grew up in the Midwest, and so I've incorporated a barbecue and strong. We do wood-fired pizza in the venue as well. So we have all three elements of my menu sort of incorporated into the name, the Korean, the American, and the Japanese. That also sort of portrays what my personal culinary history is. So
that makes sense. So I want to talk about après-ski, because that's something that I know we've all been searching for. People have tried it. You did talk about that relationship with Jackson, and I know that, you know, they've been doing a lot of work themselves on just building a name and a brand. And I didn't think, but you did mention, the lift is just right there. You know, you ski across the bridge, you take off the skis, or you could, just walk across, even not even have to walk across a street to get off the resort to get to your place.
Exactly. And, you know, as you said, 22 years ago when I was first here, we used to be able to take our skis off leisurely at the bottom of the town lift and wander up to the middle of Main Street and have a beer or have a little bite to eat. Well, as we all know, the popularity of Park City has grown so much. It's not really feasible to walk into No Name, for instance, and leave your skis in the front by the coat rack like it used to be.
Not gonna happen.
So since we've grown to that point, and it's harder to move around Main Street, we felt like there was a definite void to fill, and we were very fortunate to find the location so close to Town Lift. So the idea is that in that lower Marriott Summit Watch Plaza, we'll have the Jackson's Base Camp, we'll have the Banchan Izakaya, and so it really invites not only locals but the ski business to transition right from the Town Lift without taking their equipment off over to either their rental spot, their ski storage spot, and also their après and dining spot.
Now, I want to go through a little bit of what I'm going to find on the menu, but first I'm going to ask, is the menu online so that as we talk about it, people can go look at it?
It is.
And what's that website,
our
please?
Website is banchanpc.com. We're also sort of active on Facebook and Instagram. Our Instagram is banchan, at banchanpc.
And if I go there, tell me what I'm going to see on that menu and what kind of price points am I looking at?
So, as I said, the philosophy of the menu is to be multifaceted in that we encourage people to order more than one item. We term our different plate sizes as small plates or bigger plates. Bigger plates include things like sandwiches and noodle dishes. But again, they are all in moderate portions and moderate price points that would encourage you to try different areas of the menu. As I said, we span from the Korean menu. We do our own kimchi in-house. We have bulgogi throughout the menu. We found that a lot of the interesting Korean ingredients farewell on our pizza as well, so we've
really?
We've incorporated that. And then on the Japanese side, we do a little bit of temaki or hand roll sushi, even though we're not a sushi bar. But that sort of highlights our seafood more than it does the style of cuisine that we're doing. On that note, we have the sushi quality fish for the temaki or the hand roll, but we also do a great tuna tartare, great ceviche. And so not only is our menu wide-ranging, I think it accomplishes the feat of having something for everyone. We've been extremely popular with family groups, too, because the adults may like something more adventurous on the menu, and the kids can always revert back to a pizza if they need to.
It's always good to cover those bases. I had the opportunity to dine in July. The carnitas, bao buns, unbelievable. And the dragon scales. Those were my two favorite on the list. Many people may not know, but you are located where the old Vinto restaurant is. You have an amazing outdoor dining area. Tell me what your goal is for your first year. What are you hoping to accomplish?
So we actually, as you noted, took over at the end of the winter and actually opened in June. So again, we For better or for worse, we accomplished a summer opening, which would have been probably unheard of in Park City 10 years ago. But we've done fairly well. We've obviously relied upon our local business and local connections, and they've been fantastic. Again, we're a small, locally owned business between Jackson and I, so as far as the renovations, improvements, construction, it's all moved very sort of organically at the pace when we could accomplish it. So moving forward this winter, I think we've done a great job of settling ourselves through the summer, which, as we know, is typically a little bit of a down season. Of course, the last two summers were record-setting, as we know, so a little bit of a change. But moving towards the winter, we plan on opening four appraise service. So we want to do like a 3 o'clock at least afternoon opening to attract the crowd after skiing. And then moving forward, we'd really like to cultivate the appraise crowd by having availability even outside, much in the same way that Deer Valley has the beach at the bottom. Canyons has the tombstone. We'd love to have that eventually.
Sounds perfect. We've been speaking with Matt Fisher. He is the owner of Banchan American Izakaya.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.